Well, thank you very much. Has everyone got a handout, by the way? Excellent, very good. And this is, as you mentioned, the fifth in the series of lectures on learning and doing, and it's called Moral Intuitions, Moral Judgment, and Moral Agency. And we're going to talk a bit how those are interlinked. Let me mention again, there's going to be a discussion seminar tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. in the Ryle Room in the Radcliffe Humanities Building over there. Everyone is welcome to come. Bring whatever questions you like. Today, I'm going to make my shameless appeal to authority right at the beginning. This is a remark of Hume's. Every particular man has a peculiar position, and I'm sorry that he uses man, but that's Hume. Every particular man has a peculiar position with regard to others, and 'tis impossible we could ever converse together on any reasonable terms were we each of us to consider characters and persons only as they appear from his peculiar point of view. In order, therefore, to prevent those continual contradictions and arrive at a more stable judgment of things, we fix on some steady and general points of view and always in our thoughts place ourselves in them, whatever may be our present situation. And so this is going to be a theme of today's talk. And we're going to begin with skill and intuition, which is where we left off at the end of the previous talk. So my goal is to try to build a unified account of how rationality operates in desire, belief, and action. And I've emphasized how much the basic states of belief and desire, given their structural characteristics and regulative character, can contribute to our capacity to be rational in what I've called the wide sense of being aptly responsive to reasons. They are, in effect, what we call intelligent regulators of our dispositions to do things like attend, perceive, recall, infer, expect, act, be motivated, and so on. And we also saw that there are very good reasons for thinking that intelligent regulators will build models of the systems that they regulate. And in this case, it will be the physical and social world and its prospects and perils for the individual, as well as the individual's own resources and capacities to act. So here's the silly picture I've been drawing of belief and desire. And as you'll see, they involve both a central regulative element, the representation in virtue of the affective attitude, regulates a component of action, focused motivation or focused reliance. And that in turn leads us to expect or to affectively predict a certain outcome. Whether the object, when actually brought about, has that feature, then can feed back and can increase or decrease or stabilize the degree of preference or the degree of confidence. And these models can be understood as something like network-like representations. They use experience to build up relations of informational and causal relevance. And recall the rat that we saw in the maze. So remember that rats map the space of their physical environment not only egocentrically, but what's called allocentrically, that is in terms of a grid system that doesn't refer to their specific location. And recall that rats learning a maze acquire a representation that's a stable representation. They can then replay that in their sleep, simulating paths in the maze. In doing, they will construct novel paths, paths that they have not visited. So they're using this representation generatively to create new possibilities for action. And they also use this representation prospectively as they are acting to sweep out possible actions and evaluate them and decide among them on the basis of those evaluations. So this model building business is a serious business, and it's a fundamental part, I want to claim, of the psychology of intelligent animals and a fundamental part of the psychology of humans. And what we've seen is this kind of a picture in the last couple of lectures, this kind of model-based perspective idea of desire and belief enables us to say something about how we could have skill with things like responding to reasons or skill with reasoning. So in the third lecture, we talked about having the right kinds of intelligent dispositions to shape what one notices, what one calls to mind, what options one considers, and so on, in order to act intentionally in response to reasons for action, without needing a prior intention to do so. That is, these states have enough structure that they can guide even the formation of intentions without requiring a prior intention and therefore avoiding the regress with which we began. In lecture four, we looked at how the same kinds of intelligent dispositions to recognize situations, let's say epistemic situations, is apt for a certain kind of inference, that can guide the application of a rule, can monitor whether the rule is being applied successfully or not, and can do that not on the basis of a rule, but on the basis of a predictive, projective model of this kind. And so again, we get an account of rule following that doesn't presuppose a rule and doesn't launch a regress. So these are forms of skill with reasons and skill with reasoning. Now, phrenology alert here. I try not to show you too many brain images, and I recognize that they have not only limited power to persuade, but they're based on fairly approximate readings. But I do want to mention that this business of model building is is a sufficiently important part of the mind that it actually is a stable system in the mind, which is one of two major modes of functioning within the mind. It's the default network, as it's called. And what we saw is that the default network is involved in memory, organizing and using memory, retrieving memories. It's involved in envisioning the future, projecting forward, the way the rat projects forward on the basis of its memories of the maze. And in humans, it's related to theory of mind, the way in which we understand the psychology of the people around us and read the social situations we inhabit. And this, as I say, is one of two major modes of functioning of the brain. It consumes every bit as much resources as more task-oriented modes in the brain. And it's doing this in order to situate you in a set of reasons that you could not successfully respond to by something like deliberative reasoning. But by underwriting your intelligent dispositions, it makes it possible for you to do something like deliberate reasoning and do so reasonably well. Okay, so this is, I'm claiming, a kind of a skill. It involves these kinds of representational structures. If you're interested in the debate between intellectualists and non-intellectualists about skill, this is, in a sense, an intellectualist position, because it says that a skill involves these large-scale representational structures. On the other hand, these structures are not just sets of propositions. They're also the structures that are used for guiding motor commands and guiding action. And in that sense, they have a polyvalent character. There is an exchange economy within the mind among various affective states and objects. And so the idea is that this kind of a skill, which translates into fluency in action, is informationally very intense, but it's not simply inferential. Indeed, it's key to the process that it's not simply inferential. So skill isn't something like muscle memory. Skilled athletes don't have fixed action patterns that they perform more efficiently than ordinary people. They show more variation and more spontaneity in their behaviors than really very good athletes. This kind of a knowledge system permits spontaneous adaptation to changing and novel context. We see that in the rat, imagining new mazes, new paths through the maze. And they can do it thanks to these complex representational structures, which have mind-to-world direction of fit. That is to say, they represent the world, and they can do so in ways that are more or less accurate, more or less proportional to the evidence, more or less comprehensive, and so on. And such skilled capacities are often called intuitive, and that brings us to our theme for today, the idea of intuition, and especially moral intuition. So recall we had this notion that there are multiple dimensions of mind-to-world direction of fit. There can be the directedness toward the object, the accuracy, the proportionality, and appreciation or understanding. And these are characteristics that are possible even for, say, belief-like states, even though we may not speak of belief-like states themselves as typically true or false, or degrees of belief, for that matter, which we don't speak of as in themselves true or false. Okay, so that's the picture. Today we're going to turn to the moral case, and we're going to ask, can this stuff help us in any way thinking about morality and moral intuitions, which are spontaneous responses to real or imagined situations, and they are, in a sense, candidates for this kind of an analysis. Okay, well, moral thought and practice are well known to rely extensively on intuition at all levels. There are intuitions about fundamental principles, intuitions about particular cases. There's the method of reflective equilibrium, in which one tries to come to an equilibrium between particular cases and general principles. Some people think that is the method of ethics. It's the sole foundational method of ethics. Now, the intuitionists, this probably should have had a capital I, the intuitionists had a story about these intuitions. They were rational, a priori insights into self-evident truths. And they, I take it, were quite well convinced by this. We find it very hard to be convinced that our judgments about particular moral situations are like that. Moreover, there's been an extensive critique in recent years coming from various directions of this idea of synthetic, a priori, rational, self-evident intuitions. Morality wouldn't look the way it does if we had that power. And so in that sense, then, we've got a bad conscience here in ethics. We're relying throughout on intuition, and we have almost no story about what these intuitions are, where they might come from, and why they might deserve some kind of credence. Okay, how about intuition? What makes something an intuition? I want to start with a kind of minimal notion. I don't want to claim it has any particular epistemic status or metaphysical character. I just want to describe what I think of as a common notion of intuition, that we often find ourselves with some spontaneous sense that a thought or an action or a state of affairs or a person or something like that is implausible or plausible, right or wrong, trustworthy or dubious, dangerous, not working properly, and so on. These, this is a sort of spontaneous sense. It doesn't require explicit, effortful, controlled reasoning or judgment. It often emerges immediately in an actual or hypothetical situation. It typically arises non-voluntarily. It comes to us. It doesn't come as a result of our making it or going after it. And it can be quite recalcitrant in the face of our considered judgments. As a card-carrying consequentialist for many years, I still find the intuitions that people report ordinarily in the trolley problem very compelling. I'm going to try today to say something about those intuitions. But it's not as if by being a card-carrying consequentialist, I could make them go away. And that's a good thing, because I now realize that they shouldn't go away. So, what else about intuitions? They're experienced as compelling or motivating. We're reluctant to give them up or ignore them. If you have an intuitive sense that a situation is not safe, and someone says, oh, but look, everything is fine. I checked. You're not typically reassured by that. Your intuition has a kind of compellingness that is, in that sense, for you and your own self, convincing. Even when you can't give a fully articulate or satisfactory explanation or justification of it. And intuitions are not just one-shot things. We philosophers often concentrate on that thought. But we can speak of someone acting intuitively over a long stretch of time. A musician improvising, for example, can be acting intuitively without conscious, self-conscious deliberation, responding to an incredibly complex set of rhythmic and melodic and dynamic considerations, doing that intuitively. And so intuition has got this power to guide action and not simply produce these individual judgments. And no doubt there are other features of intuitions in this ordinary sense. I hope these are relatively uncontroversial. And again, I don't want to presuppose that they're somehow privileged, that they have a special epistemic status in virtue of these features. Okay, well, what would make an intuition be a moral intuition? The thrust of the kinds of psychological and philosophical criticisms of intuitions that we're going to be considering are typically that they try to show that what we take to be a convincing moral intuition is actually responsive and systematically responsive to morally irrelevant considerations. Unresponsive to morally relevant considerations. And so for this, we need some notion of what would count as a morally relevant consideration. And that's, of course, going to be controversial. Everything in this area is going to be controversial, but there are some things we can say with relatively less controversy than others. Moral considerations are supposed to be general. They're supposed to be independent of parochial interests or perspectives. They're supposed to be linked to considerations of well-being, intrinsic value, respect for persons. They're supposed to be independent of sanction, not depending upon conventional authority. So just take those ideas in mind and say, what would be then to have an intuition that was a moral intuition would be one that purported to have these characteristics, and what it would be for it to be not responsive to genuinely moral considerations would be for it to purport that, but in fact to be responsive to something that's parochial, perspective dependent, quite independent of considerations of intrinsic value, dependent upon the situation, its sanctions, and so on. Okay, so what are the forces that are arrayed against intuition in ethics? Evolutionary psychology, we'll talk more about this next time. Could we expect evolution to have given us a psychology that would be capable of anything that looks like a genuine moral intuition? There's historical and social variability. Of course, going back, looking over time, we see that people had different intuitions at different times. We know that the intuitions we have now will look to our our descendants as in many ways benighted and prejudiced and parochial. So we recognize that there is this variability. On the other hand, that doesn't in itself suffice for us to lose the force of the intuitions. There are persisting intuitive disagreements. If intuition were the kind of thing that was just a self-evident truth, why would we have these persistent moral disagreements? And in particular, the thing I'm going to focus on today are the so-called dual process theories of mind and judgment, and what those theories tell us about potential intuition. Okay, so let's say a bit about dual process theories. There's a huge body of literature out there in psychology, social psychology, and so on, according to which people often rely upon spontaneous intuitive reactions when they're making judgments and acting. These reactions rely upon implicit heuristics and biases. These heuristics and biases have little understanding of logic or statistics. Their operation is fairly automatic. It's fairly invisible to us how they operate. It's not introspectively available, so we typically can't say when these intuitions are based on heuristics, what heuristics they're responding to. They are highly dependent upon the framing of a situation, with the result that individuals can have different intuitive responses to mere reformulations of the same situation. And because of this, when people are asked to justify their intuitions, they often confabulate. They've got to come up with some reason for having this clear intuition. Since they can't introspect what it is, and they certainly can't introspect that it's based upon the availability heuristic, they will try to fill in some kind of a story. Now, there are various forms of the dual process theory. The very strong form, and the one that's really been most influential in a lot of the moral literature, thinks of this as actually two systems. There is an intuitive, largely implicit, and evolutionarily ancient system that we inhabit from our mammalian ancestors. It's fast and effortless. It's affect-laden. That's the great innovation of mammalian psychology, the affect system. It's heuristic-based. It's based on fairly simple responses, push-button responses, point-and-shoot responses, as Haidt and Green put it, responses that a chimpanzee could easily understand. And this system operates in parallel with another system, which is evolutionarily more recent. It requires deliberation. It's largely explicit. It's slow and effortful. It draws upon scarce cognitive resources. It can do probabilistic and logical reasoning, but it can do so painfully, slowly, and difficultly, and so therefore quite often System 1 preempts its operation. So how do these views relate to the ideas of moral judgment as we understand it? Well, we don't, again, have to insist that there are two systems or say that moral judgment comes from one system or the other. Really, the way the views are used typically is to say that because these systems operate on different principles and at different velocities and with different degrees of force and vividness, they can compete. They can give us competing assessments of a situation. And some of the peculiarities of moral judgment, the kinds of patterns of moral judgment that people find puzzling, they may be explained by the fact that this one is attributable to System 1 operation, this one to System 2, and the fact that we can't find an easy way or principled way to reconcile them should lead us to understand that that isn't because there's a fundamental principle we're missing, it's because these are fundamentally different processes. So what are some well-known examples? Here I apologize, we're going to have to talk about trolleys. familiar example, trolley switch. There's this runaway trolley coming down the track. The driver is slumped over the controls. You're standing happily, I suppose, next to a switch. On the other hand, you've now faced with a dilemma because you could switch it away from the five workers on the main track. But if you do so, you now realize there's a worker on the side track who will certainly be hit and killed should you throw the switch. And here's a verdict, a typical verdict from my undergraduates. Between 67, sometimes 80, sometimes more percent say you should pull the lever, but a healthy percentage say that you should not. And then you all know what's coming next, right? The next thing to come along is the footbridge example, where you're standing on a footbridge over the trolley track. It's still a runaway trolley, and there's this very large gentleman next to you. And you're slim and lithe and so on, very athletic, and you're just not enough to stop a trolley. This large gentleman, on the other hand, is enough to stop a trolley, and so you could, by pushing him off the footbridge onto the tracks, stop the trolley and save the five workers. Okay, so should you do that? Should you push the man off the bridge to stop the trolley and save the five workers? And here's a typical response of my undergraduates. The first time they encounter this example, it flips. They say, no, you should not do so. And this gives us the classic trolley asymmetry. And so the question is, what explains this? Why in some cases can we sacrifice one to save five, and in other cases we can't? And because people have often very little insight into why that would be, the question for the psychologist is, what's going on psychologically to give us this difference in judgment? And so, of course, as soon as they had the chance, they started putting people in scanners and taking functional magnetic resonance imaging. This is Josh Green and colleagues. And what they found in the early research, these bars correspond to levels of activation measured by blood oxidation levels. And they divided moral dilemmas into two kinds. The dark ones, the black ones, are personal moral dilemmas. The ones that are in white are what are called impersonal moral dilemmas. The gray ones are non-moral dilemmas. And what they found was that in the moral personal dilemmas, and they thought of footbridge as an example of that because it involves this very personal confrontation with the individual who's going to perish as a result of your action, they found that there was a great deal of activation in areas of the brain that they associated with emotion. On the other hand, if you look at areas associated with working memory, which is a standard cognitive function, there was not great activation. In some cases, there was lower activation in these cases than there is in just a standard non-moral dilemma. If, on the other hand, you look at the impersonal dilemmas, like switch, for example, what you'll see is the emotional areas are not terribly active, but the areas associated with working memory are. And so the conclusion they came to is that this asymmetry is explained by the fact that the footbridge verdict is a hot, fast emotional response. The switch verdict is a response that has very low emotional valence, but instead works very well with a calculation of minimizing harm. And so the difference between these is not to be explained by a moral principle, but by the fact that they're being treated differently by two different systems. Okay, so that's the explanation. And Green and others have tried to draw further morals from this, namely that the attempt to use the trolley problem to refute utilitarianism can't succeed, because if what explains the footbridge verdict is not some kind of a deontological principle, but just squeamishness, and since we largely concede that squeamishness as such is not a morally decisive consideration, then we should pay more attention to the verdicts that are more cognitive, such as the verdict that we get in switch, which look more utilitarian. Okay, so that's a way of trying to extract normative relevance out of this work. Okay, now you might say, look, there's some obvious principle here. You're not supposed to use people as means. In the switch case, it's an unfortunate side effect of what you're doing that the person is killed, but in the trolley case, you're actually using this individual as a means to stop the trolley, intending that they gum up the trolley's wheels and stop it to save the men. And so, of course, the next thing that philosophers did was to come up with the example of loop. In loop, the trolley is coming down the track as before. You can either switch it to a sidetrack or you can let it go continuing down the main track. If you switch it down the sidetrack, it will hit this individual and stop. That will save the five men. If you leave it on the main track, it will hit these individuals and stop, and therefore this man won't be in peril. Now, if you decide to switch it, you're using this individual as a means to protect these five. And so a simple means-end principle doesn't seem to work. So what happens if you ask people about trolley loop? Is that acceptable? And here is a typical response from my undergraduates. 90% in this case said that you should pull the lever in trolley loop. Whereas in footbridge, where you're also using the person as a means, of course a majority said no. So what happens then if we ask about the trolley loop case? Is this like the impersonal case where the emotional system is not heavily involved? Or is it like the footbridge case and it's more like the impersonal case? And so again, this is a more cognitive judgment. That's the idea. Similar case, again, I apologize for using these examples. They're the kinds that psychologists use because they get effects. This is supposed to be an example of moral dumbfounding, where people have a moral verdict, a strong moral verdict, but they can't explain it. And then the question is, where does it come from in their psychology if they can't give it a good explanation? So here's Julie and Mark, their brother and sister. They're traveling together in France on summer vacation from college. One night they're staying alone in a cabin near the beach. They decide it would be interesting and fun if they tried making love. At very least, it would be a new experience for each of them. Julie was already taking birth control pills, and Mark uses a condom too, just to be safe. They both enjoy making love, but they decide not to do it again. They keep that night as their special secret, which makes them feel even closer to each other. What do you think about that? Was it okay for them to make love? And most people say, no, it was not okay. And then you say, well, why was it not okay? They say, well, everyone knows that incest causes psychological trauma. You say, well, but look, there's no psychological trauma here. Well, it causes birth defects. No, there's no danger of birth defects here. Well, incest involves attitudes of coercion or dominance. Well, no, actually, these were just two adults making a decision, and they found it helped their relationship. So after a certain point, people run out of explanations, and they say, look, it's just wrong. And that's considered the phenomenon of moral dumbfounding. Again, if it's based on what Haidt thinks it's based on, which is, he says, as soon as you hit that word, making love with each other, for brother and sister, you get an intuitive flash of disgust. That flash of disgust makes you averse to the action, and so you ignore all the evidence about the lack of harmful effects, and you condemn the action outright. So that's, again, a dual system approach. Well, I'm no psychologist. I can't run experiments, but I can take advantage of my captive audience, which is students. And so what I've been doing in recent years when I teach introductory ethics is what's called informal classroom sampling. The students have little eye clickers, little remote devices. Have people seen these? Used to be in an ethics class, you'd pose the trolley problem. You say, well, what do you think? Should you throw the switch? And the average individual would do this. So that was about what we got out of these samples in the old days. But now they've got these eye clickers, which are confidential. They're personal to them. I don't know who's giving what response. They can give an honest response. And what's interesting about these responses is that they do give them. They don't refuse to do this. They give these responses, and they're very interested in them. I can flash the results up on a screen after 10 seconds of sampling. They're intensely interested in that. What I know from talking to students is they're trying to give the most honest answer they can because they're intensely interested, and they want the other students to do the same thing. And those who have done controlled experiments on the same students with the same problems find that they essentially give similar results. So it's informal. It doesn't go through human subjects research. You can report me. I'll probably end up in jail. But this is a way of getting information, and I present it to you for what it's worth. Okay, so let's just try asking these students some questions now that they're stuck in the classroom with me. Suppose we ask, is it a reason for pushing the man from the footbridge that this would result in fewer deaths of innocent people? And 90% say yes. Okay, well, that seems like a reasonable thing to say. So they're not ignoring the fact that that's a reason for it on this account. Is it a reason against pushing the man, that you'd be directly causing his death using your own arms? And 83% say no. Now, of course, what the psychologist is going to say is, Railton, you idiot. This is their self-report. Of course they're going to say these things because they want to represent themselves as rational individuals. But in fact, it's precisely the creation of the death by directly using their muscular force that is what's driving this, and they're ignoring the possible benefits of doing so. So let's just introduce some new cases. We've got to prowl around here. We've got the standard trolley cases where you have intervention. Harming one to save five should not be done according to most subjects. That's footbridge, and it involves direct muscular use of to inflict harm. We've got the ones where intervention harming one to save five should be done according to most subjects, and there's no direct use of muscular force to inflict harm, and that's like switch and loop. But what about these other two boxes? What if we look for cases that fit those boxes? So here's the first. I call this one bus. So you're in a city where there's been a history of terrorist bombing. The population has gotten very savvy about this, and so they're good at detecting terrorist bombers and trying to wrestle them to the ground and stop them from doing what they're going to do. So what the bombers are doing is they're watching a public conveyance, let's say a train or a bus, and at a crowded time, they rush at the very last instance as the door is closing, triggering their bomb as they jump on board so that no one has a chance to stop them. And so there you are, it's 5:30, you're on a crowded bus, you're getting off at your stop, the doors are opened like so, you and another fellow, a large fellow standing next to you are getting off the bus at your stop, and you notice coming up from the side, there's this person with an overcoat, there are explosives strapped to his chest, and he's got a big trigger in his fingers, and so you see this person running directly at the bus. Now what should you do? One thing you could do is just continue getting off the bus. That individual will get on the bus behind you, the doors will close, you'll be safe on the sidewalk along with this large gentleman, but the people on the bus will suffer the effects of the explosion. Maybe half a dozen die, half a dozen seriously injured, and so on. Or what you could do is, as this guy is charging at the bus, since you can't reach him directly, you can push the large gentleman on top of him. They both fall to the sidewalk. You fall back in the bus. The doors shut. The people on the bus and you are saved. So I give this question to my students. What should you do? And here they say, you should push. So here's a case of direct use of muscular force to inflict a grisly death on a person. But a majority of the students say you should push in this case. So that's the first example of filling in a box. Notice that in this case, it's very asymmetric with the trolley footbridge case, even though they both use personal force. And it's rather similar to this trolley switch case, even though that is a remote or impersonal kind of case. Well, we got to look at the why box we forgot about. And this I call beckon. This requires a little imagination on your part. So the trolley's coming down the track as before. There are five railroad workers working away and not noticing the trolley. They're going to be struck and killed. There's a shelter alongside the trolley track, where the pedestrians can wait. And there's a very large gentleman standing next to the shelter. He doesn't see the trolley coming. He's looking in your direction. You don't have a switch or anything like that, but you're standing over here. And if you wave to him, again, hey, over here, the large gentleman will step forward onto the trolley track and stop the trolley and save the park. Okay, got that scenario? Should you beckon to the large gentleman? Well, this is equal time here. Should you beckon to the large gentleman? No, you should not do that. So here's a case, there's no direct use of muscular force, but the students judge in the just about the same percentage as they do in the case of Woodbridge that you shouldn't do this. Well, maybe there's something fishy about waving a person into a situation where they die, and certainly there is something fishy about that. But let's consider another case. So you've got to use your imagination again. Trolley's coming down the track. There are five workers who are going to be hit. You're standing even further down the track. The workers are looking in your direction. They don't see the trolley coming. You can see it coming behind them. And there are five workers standing on the track and one worker standing beside the track. So you're down here and they're looking at you. And if you go that way, the five workers who are on the track will step to the side and be saved. But the one worker who is beside the track will also step aside and be hit. Okay? So, should you wave? Should you, in this sense, beckon? Yes, you should do so, according to my students, by a fairly large, very healthy majority. So that's interesting. In this case, you should wave. In the other case, you should beckon. And again, you might look at these cases and say, all you're doing is making things worse. You're just showing that there's this complete chaos in these examples. So let's continue to pursue this a bit further. So here's a comparison of switch and wave, showing the extent to which those are similar cases. And here's the asymmetry between wave and beckon, which is very similar to the asymmetry between trolley footbridge and trolley switch. So what if we draw on the thing that we started off with, which is the idea of a sort of skill-based approach, a model theoretic approach? What if what students are doing is actually forming a model of the situation, a model of the available actions, a model of the agent? It doesn't have to be a perspectival model. It can be like the model that rats form of the space that is available to them to move around in. They're evaluating possibilities within this space. And in doing so, they're assigning different values to these actions in these different scenarios. So how would I ever figure that out? Well, again, they're stuck in my classroom, so I can ask them more questions. What if you came home one day to your apartment and your roommate showed up very upset and you said, what's happened? He said, well, I was in this terrible situation. There's this runaway trolley. There's this switch. I saw that there were five workers. There was one guy in the side track. I had to do it. I threw the switch at the last minute and it killed this worker on the side track. And now I'm completely distraught. So suppose that were true. This is what your roommate or friend tells you. Would you trust that individual more, the same, or less on hearing that information? And you can see that it's basically a wash. There's a bit more and a bit less, but mostly the same. What about footbridge? Suppose you came home and your roommate was all upset and saying, this is a terrible situation. I pushed this man off the bridge in front of a trolley. Would you trust your roommate more, the same, or less? Okay, well, there's something about the roommate now that worries you that didn't worry you about this roommate before. Well, what about loop? What if you learned your friend had pulled the switch in loop? Would you trust the roommate more, the same, or less? This is the familiar pattern that we got with switch. What about wave? Would you trust your roommate more, the same, or less? This is the same pattern that we got with switch and with loop. And what about beckon? Would you trust your roommate more, the same, or less? And so what you see in beckon is a very similar verdict to the footbridge verdict. So here you see what they look like. There's a similar pattern for trust and wave. There's a similar pattern for beckon and footbridge, but it's a pattern in which you infer a kind of character for the individual knowing that they've performed this action. And it's interesting to notice, for example, if you look at the footbridge case, 31% think that should happen. You should get pushed, but nobody trusts the person more who could do it. So this is not just a judgment about the rightness of the action, it's a judgment about what kind of a person would be so disposed as to be able to do this action, and the same thing is true in beckon. 36% said you should beckon, but nobody trusts more a person who's capable of doing that. And you may very well have that same feeling as I gave you the examples here. Now, maybe the students are just making this stuff up. So I started prowling around the psychological literature, and the psychologists have gone crazy with the trolley problem. They've run it thousands of times in different countries in different variants, and they've done psychological profiles of the people who give different answers. And so here's some of the results they've gotten. So Bartels and Pizarro, Gao and Tang, and Kahane et al. Found that the likelihood of giving a push verdict in footbridge-like scenarios was not correlated with general altruism, but with rating on a psychopathy scale, egoism, and disregard for moral violations generally. Okay, is that the kind of person you would trust as a roommate? Conway and Goronsky and others found that there were decreased levels of empathy, harm aversion, and perspective taking in those who give push-like responses in the footbridge scenarios. Duke and Begg found that a higher blood alcohol level predicted a greater tendency to give push-like verdicts, lower inhibitions. Ullman found that the individuals who make these judgments seemed to be projecting a model of the agent as lacking in empathy when they made these judgments about the situation. And very recently, Everett found that there were inverse inferences of the kind we talked about last time, where you're making an inverse inference from an act to a model of the agent, were being made actually of something like the trustworthiness of agents in trolley scenarios. So I was pleased to have that, at least that amount of indication. So I suspect the students are really tracking something in these judgments about trustworthiness. They are experienced modelers of social situations, and they can extract from those models information about what kind of an individual would perform a given action. What about bus? Remember, bus, a majority said that you should push, even though it involved direct use of muscular force in this very grisly setting. Would you trust your roommate more, the same, or less if he pushed in the bus case? And what's interesting is that about 4 years out of five, they say more as a stronger response than just the same or less. And you might think, well, why would that be? I mean, don't you worry that your roommate's going to push you in front of a bus? You think, no, what your roommate is telling you is that in a situation of desperate danger, he will act in the form of community self-defense. He will protect those who are at greatest risk of the bomb, and he will do so even though it requires an unflinching act. And so this is the only case I found where I got an increase in trust in the individual. I perhaps could find others. Okay, so what's going on? Are the students mentally simulating? Is that going on? Well, Amit and Green found that if you did an intervention which prevented people from visualizing the situation, that increased the pushing responses in footbridge-like dilemmas. Now, they inferred, because you're stopping that intuitive, fast, push-button, hot response, they're giving a more utilitarian verdict. But another response is if you interfere with their ability to visualize, they can't use their projective modeling as effectively. So, again, I've got these students. I can ask them. You know, this is self-reporting. It's not high science, but it's interesting. I ask, when you considered the switch case, which victims seemed to you most proximate? All six, the single man on the sidetrack, or the five workers? So that's the pattern I got with switch. Most people said all six. Here's the pattern I got with wave. All six, the single individual, or the five workers. Okay, so there's a similarity here too in the way that they're visually simulating the situation in terms of the imaginative proximity. What about footbridge and beckon? Was it all six? Was it the single man or was it the five workers? The five workers have disappeared pretty much in these cases. What's proximate imaginatively to them is the one individual who's going to be pushed to their death. So that gets footbridge and beckon into the same category. What about bus? Is it all six? Is it the man exiting the bus? Or is it the people on the bus who will be saved? This is the one case I found where the people who will actually be saved, the five workers or the five people on the bus, that's the most proximate. And so what this suggests is the bus scenario gets you into a situation where you empathically simulate what really is going to happen to those people on the bus. They are imaginatively proximate, and that's why protecting them is felt to be not a form of untrustworthiness, but a form of social reliability. Okay, what about reactive attitudes? Suppose you had been in a switch situation and you had pulled the switch, killing the worker on the sidetrack, but saving the five other workers. Now, you're a good person. You feel you have to go to the family of this individual whom you killed, and you have to talk to them about it and see what they say. So I ask my students, which comes closest to describing how you believe you would likely feel? Would you be deeply regretful, sympathetic for their loss, and with a reasonable hope they might understand? Would you be deeply regretful, guilty, and sympathetic for their loss, with some hope they might understand? Or deeply regretful, ashamed, and sympathetic for their loss, with little hope they might understand? Which comes closest to what you think your attitudes would be in that situation? And what we see here is that the strongest response was regretful, guilty, and sympathetic with some hope that they would understand. Some thought that they would be regretful and sympathetic with a reasonable hope they'd understand. The least likely response was that they would be regretful, ashamed, and sympathetic with little hope that they could understand. They didn't have that desolate picture of the situation. Well, what about footbridge? Suppose we ask exactly the same question about footbridge. Which of these would be most likely or most closely approximating what they feel? And notice in this case what we get. They would feel the strongest response is regretful, ashamed, and sympathetic with little hope that they would understand. So looking at the problem in terms of reactive attitudes, again, what we find is that there is a systematic difference in the way that they understand the situation, the students understand the situation, and that that systematic difference predicts to the kind of pattern of verdicts that we get. Okay, so here's the comparison between the two. Now, I'm going to stop talking about trolleys for a little bit. We may come back. We're going to come back to them later. Sorry. But I have to talk about some other examples that have been very important in this literature. People know about the Knobe effect. This is a good reason to become an experimental philosopher, because he found this effect, which was so powerful and convincing that the psychologist named it after him. So this is the Josh Knobe effect. Okay, and I'll see how you feel about these cases. The vice president of a company went to the chairman of the board and said, "We are thinking of starting a new program. It will help us increase profits, and it will also help the environment." The chairman of the board answered, "I don't care at all about helping the environment. I just want to get as much profit as I can. Let's start the new program." They started the new program. Sure enough, the environment was helped. Question, did the chairman intentionally help the environment? Okay, here's the way my students respond. 84% say no. He did not intentionally help the environment. Okay, now what are we going to do? We're going to do a minimum change in the example. Vice president comes to the chairman as before. We're thinking about starting a new program. It will help us increase profits, but it will also harm the environment. We've changed one word. The chairman of the board answers, "I don't care at all about harming the environment. I just want to make as much profit as I can. Let's start the new program." They started the new program, and sure enough, the environment was harmed. Did the chairman intentionally harm the environment? Well, most people that Knobe sampled said yes. In my classroom, I can't quite get that effect, but what you see is a striking difference between this response and the first response, between 84% saying yes and a mere 60% saying yes. And Knobe's diagnosis of this situation is that we have a response when we hear about harming the environment, which is a moralizing response. And being moralizing, we want to attach blame. We can't attach blame to this chairman unless he acted intentionally. So we think he acted more intentionally. Now, in the first case, where the environment has helped, we don't think the chairman's attitude is wonderful, because he's just saying, I don't care about helping people. So we're not trying to praise him, so we don't try to attach that action to him. We don't see it as intentional. Okay, now there's the asymmetry between the two. Let me try a different set of examples on you. You're a herder living on a hillside. Again, you'll have to use your imagination here. Above you is a neighbor with an orchard of olive trees. One day in town, you hear your neighbor being told, yes, you can use this spray on your trees and it would kill all the bugs. And when the rain comes, it will wash down onto your neighbor's field and kill the bugs that have been destroying her grass. It won't hurt the goats, it will help them. Your neighbor replies, not aware that you're present, you're listening very carefully here. I don't care at all about helping her goats. I just want to kill the bugs in my olive trees. Give me the spray. Now, where would you locate your neighbor's attitude on a scheme between ill will, neutrality, or goodwill? It's certainly not great goodwill, but he's just indifferent about whether he benefits you or not. Would you call that ill will? Where is this person? Is it more live and let live, something like that? Here's another case. You're a goat herder living in a remote village on a hillside. Above you is a neighbor with an orchard of olive trees. You hear the neighbor being told, yes, you could use this spray on your trees and it would kill all the bugs. But when the rain comes down, it will wash onto your neighbor's field and poison your goats when they eat the grass. Your neighbor replies, not aware that you're present, I don't care at all about poisoning your goats. I just want to kill those bugs. Give me the spray. Now, is that a live and let live attitude on the part of your neighbor? Or is that ill will? In other words, is the neighbor in the first example a neighbor that you're going to have to be wary of, as opposed to the neighbor in the second example, where you're going to have to be on your toes, because at any time, your neighbor is perfectly willing to cause you harm. So, my colleague Chandra Sarpata did many variants on this example, and what he found using a structural equations approach, which tries to find a mediating variable, is that people were making a judgment of the underlying value structure of the chairman, and that was mediating their judgments. So in the first case, the underlying value structure they imputed was a value structure of basically indifference to benefiting humanity, not necessarily ill will toward people. In the second case, they imputed a different value structure, a structure that looked like ill will, and it is more congruent with ill will to cause harm to people than it is congruent with indifference to cause benefit. And so in that sense, in the way in which we attribute intentionality to actions which don't involve an explicit intention, you could say that there's a better fit between the act and the intents of the chairman than in the harm case than in the help case. And so on Sripada's analysis, this is actually a fairly scientific bit of psychology on their part, understanding the way in which underlying values shape intentional behavior. Okay, now let's go back to the moral dumbfounding phenomenon. So here we've got another case. This is Janet and Matt. They're traveling together in France on a summer vacation. One night they're staying alone in a cabin near the beach. They decide it would be interesting and fun if they played Russian roulette. At the very least, it would be a new experience for each of them. Fortunately, when they spin the revolver's chambers, neither of them lands on the bullet. They both enjoy playing Russian roulette, but they decide not to do it again. They keep that night as a special secret, which makes them feel closer to each other. What about it? Do you think it was okay for them to play Russian roulette? Obviously not. Imagine if one of them had been killed. It would have destroyed a person, would destroy the other person's life. You don't do that for an interesting and fun evening. I don't think a sensible person would do that. And what seems to be going on to me in the incest case, when I think about it, is these people are taking a terrible risk with each other's psyche, with their family, with their relations with one another in the future. Why are they doing it? Because they're bored in a beach house in France? This is reckless disregard for harm that you can cause to others in the same way that playing Russian roulette would be. And so, yes, it's not okay. It's not okay to commit incest, to have a good evening, an interesting evening, or to play Russian roulette. So I don't think that you have to have some kind of bizarre flash of disgust when you hear the word incest. I think it's enough if you recognize that this is a kind of situation where they're showing insufficient motivation to avoid serious harm to themselves and others. Okay, so what I've been trying to claim then is you don't need System 1, System 2 explanations to explain these cases. You can explain them in terms of the ways in which individuals model the relations And can you do this in a way that has some interesting predictive value? Okay. Can you show, for example, that the framing effects, which are so conspicuous in the dual system approach, that those can actually be mitigated by some kind of further consideration? So what if we remove the human agent? Well, how do you remove the human agent from a trolley problem? And maybe you've all seen this. This is our now realistic trolley problem. So out there on the roads, I don't know about England, but in the US, there are hundreds of self-driving vehicles zooming around with a supposedly an attentive person sitting next to the autonomous system, but they're driving all over the place. And so the question is, how should they be programmed? They're going to come into situations that are desperate situations. So for example, if a car is coming along and some pedestrians are ignoring the light and crossing the street, and the car is going to plow into them and kill 5 pedestrians, but it could swerve to the side onto the sidewalk, but there's a single pedestrian there, it would hit and kill that pedestrian. Should the self-driving cars be programmed to swerve? And notice this is like Kant's test of the categorical imperative. Should it be a law for all mankind, right, or all rational humanity, that you swerve in a situation like this? So what would people say? Here's what my students said. 82% said it should be programmed to swerve in that situation. Okay, well, what's coming next? Here's another realistic trolley problem. Should a self-driving car be programmed such that if it's heading into an intersection and can't stop in time, it would kill 5 pedestrians? Should it swerve to the side, even though there are concrete walls on both sides of the road, and when it does so, it will kill the occupant of the car? Okay, should it be programmed to do that? My students say no. And this is the standard response that Bonifant and others got when they gave this to the general population. People said, no, it shouldn't swerve in that case. And so the question is why? And it's very similar to the trolley asymmetry between footbridge and switch. And so the question is, what explains this asymmetry? There isn't any agent here to explain it. What could lie behind it? Well, if you wanted to publish your paper in Science, you could leave things there. You have this nice puzzling effect. Or you could just start asking the kids more questions. This is what they see, right? I put up on the screen, you're vacationing in Sweden, where self-driving cars have become a common thing on the roads. You don't have a car, and you're traveling around the cities on foot. What do you think is best? Should the self-driving cars in Sweden be programmed to swerve to avoid hitting 5 pedestrians in a crosswalk, even if this means hitting 1 pedestrian in the sidewalk who is not now at risk? Should the cars be programmed to swerve in that case? They say, yes, they should, as they said before. Well, you're vacationing in Sweden as before, the same situation. Should the self-driving cars be programmed to swerve into a wall to avoid hitting 5 or more pedestrians, even though this means hitting the wall with enough force to kill the passenger in the car who is not now at risk? Now my students are at chance, right? They're 50-50 on this one. Before they were clear that the car shouldn't be programmed that way. Now they're on the sidewalk with the other pedestrians and they're thinking to themselves, huh, I wonder how these cars in Sweden should be programmed. So then I ask them, when you considered the question about the self-driving car, did you think yourself as in the car? When you imagined it, do you imagine that you were in the car? Yes, 66% say, which is roughly the percentage that said they shouldn't be programmed to slam into a wall. Okay, so I do that. I give my students this information. They have a Sweden example. They have this fact about what they were imagining. And then I let the thing sit for a little while. And so notice here we have an asymmetry of the kind that we would look to the dual system model to help us explain. So a little later, a week or so later, I ask them again, should a self-driving vehicle be programmed such that if they approach a collection of 5 or more pedestrians in the street ahead, they will swerve to the side even when this causes the car to hit a wall and kill the person in the car? We haven't discussed this in the meanwhile. Now they're saying yes. Okay. Well, maybe that's just a local effect. What if I wait until the end of the course and I ask them on the last day of class? So here's the reversal that we got over those 3-week period, and here's what we get 3 weeks later. Here's the verdict on the last day of class. Should the cars be programmed to slam into a wall, even if that means killing the occupant of the car or not? Now 70% are saying yes. So here's a case where you could have said, well, there's this horrible asymmetry in intuitive judgment, but because there's no actual agent involved, You don't have to imagine an agent with ill will. In fact, you're part of the legislative assembly thinking of what should be the laws for all autonomous car kind. And in that situation, you look at it and you can, by simulating yourself as on the sidewalk, in the car, pedestrian, and so on, you can come to a verdict, which is a stable verdict over time, that indeed there isn't an asymmetry between the case of killing an occupant of the car and killing a single pedestrian. And in fact, this is actually stronger than the verdict they have about the pedestrian, which fits with the fact that the car is, after all, the source of the menace. Okay, so removing the human agent should remove the asymmetry, and indeed, in this case, it does. Okay, well, finally, what about the neuroscience evidence? Remember the evidence that we saw from Green and others? So what if we look, now that we've had many, many years of research on trolley problems and their ilk, moral judgments, let's ask what we know about the sorts of brain systems that are involved in these moral decisions. Once again, phrenology alert, right? It's not quite phrenology, it's connectomics. This is a way of thinking about structural relations in the mind, but I realize it's too close to phrenology to be taken entirely at face value. Here's the default network that we saw before. We saw that it was involved with autobiographical memory, with envisioning the future, and with theory of mind tasks. Suppose we ask overall, you know, if you do a meta study of all these fMRI investigations of moral problems, what pattern do you see systematically in moral judgment? Here's the pattern that you see. Okay. So the pattern in moral judgment is the same as the pattern of theory of mind, same as envisioning the future, same as drawing upon your memory. In other words, it's a general system that's involved with the task of modeling the social and physical environment around you, drawing upon memory, and projecting future possibilities. That seems to be the system that's stably involved in making moral judgments. And that's what you would expect on the kind of account that we've been pushing here of stable modeling. Okay, so you get, in the end, a more unified picture of evaluation in action, that there are large-scale, functionally integrated, highly general brain networks. They recruit information widely to construct models that permit you to do prospective simulation of actions and outcomes. You can use them for yourself. You can use them for evaluating another person. You can use them for hypothetical planning. You can use them for hypothetical moral judgment. This is a quite general capacity, quite well developed in most of us. And these are the same models that guide decision and action generally. They integrate evaluative and causal information to yield expected values for actions and outcomes and agents. And you can, over the course of your moral development, come to be better and better at this kind of modeling. So the claim is, what we know about the psychology of moral judgment is still very primitive, but what it may tell us is not that we should think that moral intuitions are unreliable, that they should be discarded, that they're based in some kind of a hot-button reaction. What they seem to be telling us about moral intuitions is that they're based in the same kind of understanding that we have that enables us to understand other people's minds, enables us to understand causal relations in the world, and to engage in planning and thinking about our own future. Thanks.